700 BC. He prophesied from a little before that time to a little after that time. While he was prophesying, the northern kingdom of Israel ceased to exist as a nation. The southern kingdom of Judah almost was destroyed as a nation. The major power at that time was a kingdom named Assyria in northern Iraq today. And there was another little power, a small out-of-the-way place called Babylon, that was really a second-rate power. In fact, in Isaiah 38 and 39, in that period, we see that the king of that land, Merodach-Baladan, actually lost his throne during that period. He was kicked out of his throne as the Assyrians took over Babylon. So Judah is a small power, Babylon's a small power, Assyria is the mighty power, and in the midst of all that, Isaiah makes a rather dramatic prophecy. Chapters 13 through 23 of Isaiah are God's prophecies against the Gentile nations. God's going to destroy the Gentiles as he sets up his kingdom. And leading the list of prophecies is chapters 13 and 14 against, as he says in 13:1, the oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw. So the chapter that we're looking at, chapter 13, is against Babylon. And what does Isaiah say God's going to do to Babylon? I'll look over at we'll look at verse 9 to start. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming. If you've ever done a study in the Bible on the day of the Lord, it's that day God intervenes in history to set his account straight. It's a day cruel with fury and burning anger to make the land a desolation. He'll exterminate its sinners from it. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light. The sun will be dark when it rises. The moon will not shed its light. There'll be supernatural signs in the heavens with the sun, the moon, and the stars. If you read the book of Joel, chapter 2, or the book of Revelation, you see these kind of signs associated with God's end-time judgment on mankind. Verse 11, his judgment on Babylon. Thus I will punish, not just Babylon, I will punish the world for its evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. And I'll put an end to the arrogance of the proud and abase the haughtiness of the ruthless. I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold, and mankind than the gold of Ophir. Therefore I shall make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken from its place at the fury of the Lord of hosts in the day of his burning anger. This day God's judging Babylon is in the day of the Lord. It's in the day when there are going to be signs in the heavens that God is doing. A day when God punishes the world and settles accounts for the world. And then he goes on and tells about Babylon in verse 19. And Babylon, the beauty of kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when Sodom, or as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, how many of you have been to Israel? Oh, okay, good group. How many of you went to see the great ruins of Sodom and Gomorrah? What'd you see? Salt, right? The salt pit at the bottom of the Dead Sea. There are no ruins. There's nothing there. It's been wiped out. They've never uncovered any ruins. He says, when I get done with Babylon, in the day of the Lord, when I judge the world for its sins, when I shake the heavens, you're going to look at Babylon and it'll look like Sodom and Gomorrah. Now he goes on and explains what he means. It will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation. You won't find people living there 40, 50, 60 years, one or two generations. It will be wiped out completely. He says, no, wait a minute. That's still too long. He could allow some time there. So he shortens it a bit. Not only will they not live in it from generation to generation, nor will the Arab pitch his tent there. Now the Arab, the desert nomads, the Bedouin, or as you will, like Abraham used to live, will take their tents and their flocks and move to an area and stay there for weeks or months, sometimes even for a year or longer in one particular area. But usually it's only for a few months. They're not going to live there for generations. They're not even going to live there for a few months. The Arab won't pitch his tent there. He says, no, wait, that's still too long. Nor will shepherds make their flocks lie down there. The shepherd, as he would have his flocks out in the field looking for grass, when it would come to the cool of the evening, they would take their flocks, gather them together for the night, and watch over them. The next morning, they would get up and move on. He says, they're not even going to stay there overnight. But desert creatures will lie down there. Their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches will live there. Shaggy goats will frolic there. It'll be absolutely desolate, without human inhabitant. Isaiah said this about Babylon in 700 BC. Babylon had yet to be a major power. But Isaiah says, the day of the Lord's coming for Babylon. The day when God intervenes in the heavens and the earth. The day when God settles his accounts with mankind. And in that day, Babylon will be like Sodom and Gomorrah, totally destroyed, without inhabitants. That has never happened historically. Sennacherib came into Babylon and took the city, but it was rebuilt shortly afterward. There was never a time when it wasn't inhabited in Isaiah's day and following. The next prophet I want to look at is Jeremiah. Jeremiah was writing about a little over 100 to 150 years after Isaiah. And in Jeremiah chapter 50, Jeremiah records some events about Babylon. Now, when Jeremiah came on the scene, the Assyrians collapsed. And in their place, there was a new superpower. And this superpower was Babylon. So when Jeremiah prophesied, Babylon was the United States and Russia and Red China rolled up into one of the then-known biblical world. It was the superpower. And in chapters 50 and 51, he writes about Babylon. Notice chapter 50, verse 1. The word which the Lord spoke concerning Babylon, the land of the Chaldeans. God's going to talk about Babylon. Now, for the sake of time again, turn to verse 17. And Jeremiah writes, chapter 50, verse 17, Israel is a scattered flock. The lions have driven them away. The first one who devoured them was the king of Assyria. He took the northern kingdom into captivity. And this last one who's broken his bones is Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. He destroyed the southern kingdom of Judah. Therefore, thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I'm going to punish the king of Babylon as I punish the king of Assyria. And I shall bring Israel back to his pasture, and he will graze on Carmel and Bashan, and his desires will be satisfied in the hill country of Ephraim and Gilead. In those days, the day God punishes Babylon and brings his people back, declares the Lord, search will be made for the iniquity of Israel, and there will be none, and for the sins of Judah, but they'll not be found, for I shall pardon those whom I leave as a remnant. The day God judges Babylon is the day he brings his people back to the land and forgives them of their sins. That didn't happen historically. In fact, if you read Haggai, Zechariah, or Malachi, or the book of Ezra, or Nehemiah, you find the people were still in sin following Babylon's fall. They were never brought back to the land, united to the Lord in this everlasting covenant. But what's going to happen to Babylon? Well, verse 39. Therefore, desert creatures will live there, along with the jackals. The ostrich also will live in it. It will never again be inhabited or dwelt in from generation to generation. As when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah with its neighbors, declares the Lord, no man will live there, nor will any son of man reside in it. In the day that God brings his people back to the land and forgives them of their sin and brings about the kingdom he's promised, Jeremiah says, that day God's going to remember Babylon, and he's going to destroy it like Sodom and Gomorrah. That's never happened historically. Well, that leads us to the third passage. This is in the book of Zechariah. Next to the last book of the Old Testament, Zechariah chapter 5. Jeremiah passed off the scene, and within 50 years, Babylon was defeated by the Medo-Persian Empire, by Cyrus. And Babylon, although the city still existed, ceased to be the dominant power in the world. Instead, the Medo-Persians were. Israel was allowed to come back to the land, and they thought, maybe this is the time the kingdom's coming. But Zechariah writes to say, no, there are more things that are going to happen before the Messiah can come. And in Zechariah 5, 5 to 11, he gives an odd passage that many people have puzzled over. And he gives a vision and an explanation, and we need to look at it. Verse 5, then the angel who was speaking with me went out and said to me, lift up now your eyes and see, what's this going forth? And I said, well, what is it? He said, this is the ephah going forth. Now, an ephah is a bushel basket. It's a measure of weight. So if you can picture a flying bushel basket out there. And again, he said, this is their appearance in all the land. And behold, a lead covering was lifted up. On this basket was a heavy lead cover, and they lifted the cover off to see what was in the basket. And there was a woman sitting inside the basket. Now, this is all a vision, and when God interprets it, then we understand. And they interpret the woman, verse 8. Then he said, this woman is wickedness. This woman was the embodiment of all that was wicked and evil in the world.
And he threw it down into the middle of the ephah, cast the lead weight onto its opening. So wickedness is somehow being restrained by God in this basket with a lead weight on so that she cannot escape. Then I lifted up my eyes and looked, and there two women were coming out with the wind in their wings. And they had wings like the wings of a stork. These are angelic beings. And they lifted up the ephah between the earth and heaven. They somehow suspend this ephah. And I said to the angel who was speaking with me, where are they taking this bushel basket, this wickedness that's being restrained? And he said to me, depends on your translation here, to build a house for her or a temple for her. My translation has temple, but the word in Hebrew is bayit. It's the word house. Now they translated temple. Remember what they called the temple in Jerusalem? The house of the Lord? It's the word house, a dwelling place. And that's probably a better translation. To build a place where wickedness can again dwell. Where are they going to build it? In the land of Shinar. And Zechariah is very clear with that. The land of Shinar is first mentioned in Genesis. That's where they built the Tower of Babel. It comes up again in Daniel. That's where Daniel was taken captive. Shinar is Babylon. Babylon's already fallen. The Medo-Persians are in power. And Zechariah writes and says, wait, wickedness is being restrained by God, but eventually it's going to be rebuilt in the land of Shinar. I think in a sense, Zechariah is saying that the prophecies God spoke through Isaiah and through Jeremiah have still yet to be fulfilled. And when God's ready, when the time's right, he'll build that for her. And when it's prepared, she'll be set there on her own pedestal. Wickedness will again be in Shinar, Zechariah said. Let me summarize these three, and there are many other scriptures I could point to. But it's interesting, whether it was before Babylon became a great power, or while she was a great power, or even after she fell, in the Bible, Babylon has a special place in God's sight. From the Tower of Babel, the first place man rebelled against God, to Revelation 17 and 18, a woman riding on a beast that has to be destroyed before Jerusalem can come, Babylon's had a prominent place in God's economy. It's always been the place of rebellion, the place where man stood and shook his fist at God. And Isaiah and Jeremiah and Zechariah all say that in the end times, in the latter days, in the day of the Lord, the day God judges the world, the day God judges mankind for his sin, the day God brings Israel back to the land, the day God forgives Israel of her sins, that day God's going to judge Babylon. Now, people have read this passage. They said, well, but it can't really mean that because Babylon's not around. It hasn't existed for thousands of years. And therefore, they tried to interpret the Bible in a non-literal way and said, well, it says Babylon, but it must mean something else. I'm becoming more convinced as I study the Bible that when God says something, we ought to take him at his word. And if he says Babylon, he means Babylon. If he says the end of time, he means the end of time. And that God has said Babylon will exist at the end times. The times when he gets ready to deal with the world, when he gets ready to bring Israel back and fulfill his kingdom promises. Now, with that in mind, say, but what's there now? Hold on to that, because that comes to the third part of what we're going to talk about tonight. Now we pause, and we go to the second part. I want to share a privilege the Lord has given me. My wife doesn't think it's so much of a privilege, mind you, but I had the privilege or the opportunity to go to the country of Iraq twice, in September of 1987, and September of 1988. I need to share just briefly what happened. In 1987, Iraq was holding a Babylon festival to commemorate 20 years of rebuilding the city of Babylon under their president, Saddam Hussein. I heard about this. I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time, and I decided, boy, that would be great to go to. So I wrote to the embassy and said, would you invite me? They don't allow American tourists into Iraq. You have to be invited by the government or have some kind of business skill that a business needs there, and they will invite you. So I wrote to the embassy and asked them to invite me, and really didn't hear much. But I kept persisting. Since I was in D.C., I called every week to find out what was happening. And finally, I got an appointment with the press attaché. I went into his office and told him why I wanted to go to Iraq and why I appreciate Iraq. I've been studying it. I taught about it in my classes. And I found out he grew up just outside Iraq. Who doesn't like to hear somebody talk about their hometown, huh? He issued me an invitation. I raised the money I needed, and I went to Iraq in September of 87. What he didn't tell me at the time was that the only way he could invite me in was as an ethnomusicologist. And so I arrived. We had a group of us. There were about seven Americans. They took us to this building inside Iraq A man stood up speaking in Arabic. I put in my little earphones, the translator of earphones, and he said, "I am Munir Bashir, and I want to thank all you famous ethnomusicologists from around the world for gathering for the symposium on ethnomusicology." The only thing that went through my mind was the verse, "Even a fool, when he keeps silent, is thought to be wise." I didn't say a word. But they had us for this conference, and it was in Babylon. Now, the problem was they didn't want to show us the city. And by the second day, I realized that if I was going to see Babylon, I had to do something. So the bus pulled up, and as the group got off and went into the conference center, I started hiking back down the road to Babylon. And Munir Bashir said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Oh, it's okay, I'll be back." There were two French journalists who had also hopped on the bus, who were sneaking with me into Babylon, and we began breaking into the city of Babylon. As we rounded one corner, and I'll show you the corner in the slides, there were four Iraqi soldiers sitting, and they motioned to us to come over and shared their lunch with us. It was a chicken, a piece of onion, a cucumber, and pita bread. Not exactly a lunch, but they were very generous. We sat down, we ate with them, and then they waved at us as we climbed over the wall into the city of Babylon. So it was a great experience. One, I thought, you know, once in a lifetime. I came back, and last summer, I got a call from the Iraqi embassy saying, "Would you like to go to Babylon again?" I said, "Oh, I'd love to, but I just can't afford it." And they said, "Oh, no, no, we'll pay. You pay, I'll go." But I was ready this time. I knew that I had better get ready as an ethnomusicologist, so I wrote a paper on the musical instruments of Daniel 3. And I had an ethnomusicologist friend read it to red flag any obvious glitches that I would make. So I went with my paper, and I was prepared. And as we were riding from the bus into the from the airport to the city, the lady who's our guide said, "Are you a musician or are you a journalist?" And, "Well, no, no, I think I'm here for the ethnomusicology, an ethnomusicologist." "No, no, you're a musician or you're a journalist." I said, "Well, I have written for BibSac, so I became a journalist, writing for Bibliotheca Sacra, Dallas's theological journal." And I was there. There were three American journals represented: BibSac, National Geographic, and Aramco World. Iraq had just won the war, and as a journalist, they took us around to show us all the things that they had captured. Again, they didn't want to take us into the city of Babylon, so I had to use some creative opening of gates, and there were gates that opened, and I went through, and I got to see some more of the city. But it was an interesting experience, last September and the September beforehand. And I have slides from both, and that's what I want to end with, is showing you some of these slides. We're going to go to Iraq. I'll show you what's happening there politically, what's happening economically. And then I want to end with Babylon and show you what's happening in Babylon and tie that in with these three passages of Scripture. So if we can have the lights, I'll go over and get the clicker, and we'll look at some slides on Babylon. We've got to start with a map to know where you are. Babylon today is in the country of Iraq. It's 50 miles south of Baghdad. So just north of the little finger pointing is Babylon, and just north of that is Baghdad. Baghdad, of course, Iraq, one of the leading oil producers. Its proven oil reserves are second only to Saudi Arabia's. You get into the city of Baghdad, and this is what it looks like. It's, in fact, you feel very at home there. It's very flat, a little drier than Oklahoma and Texas. But it could be West Texas, I mean, if you didn't have the mosques there. Extremely flat. Right across from my hotel is this mosque. And you can see out in the distance, it's green because we're right by the Tigris River in Baghdad. But as soon as you get away from the water, it's absolutely barren. Here's looking the other way. And way off in the distance, on the horizon, almost on the left edge, there's a little green knob sticking up. I'll tell you about that later. It's the Martyrs Monument. Right outside my hotel window, this is the Tigris River flowing by. And again, it's a good-sized river. But the thing that they have there that you don't always see in America is that. That's a gun emplacement for anti-aircraft fire for when the Iranians would fly over Baghdad to try and shoot the planes down. There were two guns. One is always manned, even in peacetime. And again, it's a military way of life. It's technically a socialist government, but it's heavily controlled by the military. This one is harder to see, but if you can see the man walking down the street on the left side, just to his right, there's a picture hanging. The picture is of the President, His Excellency Saddam Hussein. Now, there's a Hussein who's king of Jordan and a Hussein who's president of Iraq, and they're not related. This is the president of Iraq. Saddam Hussein is, for lack of a better term, a megalomaniac. Every place you went in Iraq, at every entrance to a building, there had to be a picture of Saddam Hussein. Inside the hotel lobby, there was a picture of Saddam Hussein. In every shop we went in, there's a picture of Saddam Hussein. On a poster outside a village is a picture of Saddam Hussein. On every government building, picture of Saddam Hussein. Here's one of the government buildings just around the street from the hotel. And there's his picture. Sometimes he's dressed like this, sometimes with a family, sometimes with children, sometimes in military garb, sitting on a tank. But whatever it is, it's Saddam Hussein. And all I could think of was George Orwell's, you know, 1984 with Big Brother, and the pictures all over the place. That's what it's like. He is a Sunni Muslim. Iraq is predominantly Shiite Muslim. And so he's a minority. And to keep in power, he's trying to develop a cult of followers. And so he keeps his picture out everywhere. We went to their Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And underneath the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, literally around the whole perimeter, were pictures. And if you can see his picture here, here's Saddam Hussein with orphans. And down below is a picture of him with some of the widows. Now think back to the Bible. What kind of a man is the godly man that you're to emulate? The one who cares for the widows and the orphans? That's true in the Arabic culture. And so here's Saddam Hussein, the man who cares for the fatherless. Here we are going to one of the cities, and just a minor 20-foot high poster as we're driving by in the bus. Saddam Hussein, welcome you to the village of Samarra. Here's a cache of war weapons. I'll show you later, but who's responsible for this great military victory? Saddam Hussein. This, if you've ever been to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Washington, D.C., kind of stately, kind of plain, this is their Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. They did spend a little more money on it than we did on ours. The day we were here, they were having a commemoration, and we arrived early as a journalist, and they were lining all these kids up on both sides with flags and banners. The man just on the left has, with the cardboard box, is passing out flags and the little silver glitter. Oh, by the way, the little boys in battle fatigues, that's their version of the Boy Scouts. They dress them in military garb, prepare them early. And here's the dignitaries as they're walking back. They went up to place a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and coming back. And, of course, all the children are waving. And they were saying something. And it was in Arabic. It went, Saddam Hussein, hara, hara, hara. And I turned to our embassy person who was with us. And I said, what are they saying? And she said, they are saying, Saddam Hussein, we welcome you today. A lady beside me who spoke Arabic turned to me and said, well, really what they're saying is Saddam Hussein will give our life for you. It lost something in the official translation, mind you. But here they are flashing their victory signs, chanting this slogan. Again, from the littlest time up, they're being brought up on Saddam Hussein, this great leader of Iraq. Now here we are up on the top. There's where the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier is. Rather impressive sight. And here I am with some of the kids. They were great. The Arab people are so friendly. Their joy, and the kids were really terrific. But again, this amazing cult. Now that was the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. This is the Martyrs Monument. It's dedicated to all the Iraqis who were killed fighting the Iranians in the Gulf War. It cost $40 million. It's supposed to picture the dome of a mosque. It's split open. Half faces the sunrise, half faces the sunset. It's interesting, the side that you're looking at, the open side that's on the left, facing the sunrise, at the base of it there's a fountain with water. And it's all full of symbolism. Sunrise and water are signs of life. The sun coming up, water being life. That's symbolizing life. The other side, facing west, is facing the sunset and death. And in it, instead of a fountain, there's this giant ceramic flag of Iraq, and it symbolizes all the men who gave their lives in this war. Again, $40 million spent on that, and I'll tell you why in just a little bit. The fighting of Iran is so important in Iraq's history. Now, I was there for the Babylon Festival, and this is the symbol for it. The official slogan was, from Nebuchadnezzar to Saddam Hussein, Babylon undergoes a renaissance. You see that little poster there? You see two faces. The face on the left with the little pointy hat, that's Nebuchadnezzar. And the one on the right, who, in fact, if you could get real close, you'd see they bear a striking resemblance, is Saddam Hussein, who modestly says, "I'm the new Nebuchadnezzar." There's method behind his madness. By associating himself with Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon, he's trying to unite the Iraqis against Iraq's two historic enemies. Enemy number one, Israel. And in all their literature, they said Nebuchadnezzar was the first Arab to defeat the Jews in the land of Canaan. Think about it. And he's saying, "I'm the new Nebuchadnezzar. Guess what I'm going to do with the Arabs? Defeat the Jews in the land of Israel." So by associating with Nebuchadnezzar, he's picturing that time when the, quote, Arabs defeated the Jews. Also, by associating with Nebuchadnezzar, he says, Nebuchadnezzar was the great Iraqi who built this beautiful city, Babylon. And who destroyed it? Cyrus the Iranian. And the Iranians are the people who are the enemy, the ones who always want to destroy us Iraqi people. So he's associating himself with Nebuchadnezzar. Now, this last time I was here, we were with all these famous journalists. You may not have read much in the papers about it because, like I said, there was a National Geographic, Aramco World, and me. But there were a lot of journalists there just from other countries. The man right next to me was from Malaysia. The one next to him in the blue and white striped shirt is named Igor, no kidding, and he's from Yugoslavia. And the other girl, Zahar, is from Algeria. So the Eastern European countries, the Arab countries were all there, but not many from the United States. Now you saw all the beauty and all the money they pour into the capital of Iraq. The $40 million for the Martyrs Monument, all the weapons they buy. But the money they made from oil didn't filter down to the common people. This is how they live out in the villages. Mud-walled villages. They do have water and electricity now, but about nothing else. Here's a typical house that an Iraqi would live in out in the country. When I saw this, it reminded me of Ezekiel. Daniel lived in Babylon in the wealth. Ezekiel lived out in Tel Abib, in a small settlement, and probably lived in a house that hasn't changed much over these thousands of years. Again, we were driving by some. You can see the basically the squalor of the average person in spite of all the money they made on oil. It wasn't spent on the people. Well, here we are at JCPenney's. And again, it's the typical. If you've been to Mexico or you've been to the Middle East, you know the type of stores where you go in and bargain for things, and it's the same in Iraq. And here we are at the Skaggs. And the staple of the day, your fruits and vegetables. But one guy was really enterprising. I had a picture of him. I had one roll of film confiscated. We went to this village. We got out and took pictures. And I had changed my film. I had a new roll in. And two plainclothesmen came up to all of us and said, "Give us your film." Well, it's interesting. All the East Europeans, and there was one guy from Russia, they just start winding their film. There were two Americans and two French on the bus. And we're saying, "What? No, we're not going to give you our film. Why? What's wrong?" There was no military, nothing of significance, but this hadn't been a planned stop, and they wanted to control everything. So we were taking pictures that they hadn't planned, therefore give us your film. They took us to the police station and wouldn't let us leave till everyone gave their film. That got my anger up, so I took a lot of different pictures after that. But this was one that did survive. Well, anyway, I was telling you about the man with the entrepreneur. He had beef he was selling, so he had this quarter side of beef. He owned it on a spit, turning. And then behind him, he had a giant fan blowing into the street to blow the smell out so you got real hungry and wanted to buy his beef. It was a great idea. Another thing I found interesting there, these are brick factories. There's no stone in this part of Iraq. Everything's made from brick. In fact, here's one close up. You can see they have the furnace on the right. They have this long, low building. They would carry the bricks inside these openings, and then they would seal up most of the openings. And then a guy would go up on top, and controlling flue tiles, he could control the temperature. Why that's significant is two reasons. One, Daniel's three friends, Daniel chapter 3, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, are thrown into a fiery furnace that can be heated up seven times hotter. You know what kind of furnace they were thrown in? Probably a brick kiln. Because everything Nebuchadnezzar built was made of burnt brick. So there would have been probably hundreds of these around Babylon to supply the bricks that he needed. Second thing that's interesting is this was taken my first trip there. When I came back the second time, they were all gone. I counted 50 of these my first trip, and there were only two left my second trip. They were bulldozing them down. In fact, you can see the base in the background of one and all the rubble. And there were villages around these. They bulldozed those around. I asked my guy, I said, "Well, boy, I was here last year. There were a lot of brick kilns. What happened to them?" He says, air pollution.
Well, that's the last thing they worry about in Iraq. What it is it's very important for Iraq for face, to save face. And these squalid villages were right on this main highway. So they tore them down and just moved them out into the desert where the tourists and others wouldn't see them. But it's very important to save face. And here's another one. You can just see it's just ripped away. 48 of the 50 were gone. We went to a place called Samarra, where they had this ziggurat. This is not a reenactment of the Tower of Babel, although some think that the tower could have looked like this. This is a tower going up. Now, this is interesting. Here we are walking up to the top. OSHA would love this. You notice where they put the guardrail? But it's based on theology. If Allah wills that you die, you could be standing on the left and a brick would fall and kill you. If Allah wills you're going to live, you could jump off and you would somehow be preserved. So why put up a guardrail? You notice I'm kind of leaning over to the inside, and the further up I got, the closer I got to the inside. There were guys up there, though, because of their theology, who were pushing each other and jostling and seeing if they could put their feet over the edge and acting macho. I was not one of those. Now, we got up on top, and I want to show you this because here you think of the Fertile Crescent, and Iraq and Babylon are in the Fertile Crescent. Well, it's only fertile in a relative sense, where it's near the Euphrates and Tigris rivers. Where there's water, there's life. That's so true in all the Middle East. We're looking this way toward the Tigris River, and you can see where it turns from brown to green, right where the river is. And by the river where they irrigate, there's life. And here you can see the trees. This is one of their largest productions, date palms. But you get away from the river, and it's absolutely desolate. In fact, here we are driving back to Baghdad, and you get a little bit away from the river, and it's just pure desolation. There's a dust storm going through. But when you think of the Fertile Crescent, you don't always think of this. But it's fertile right near the rivers. Now, one of the things that they got me angry enough that I started taking pictures of were gun emplacements. And this I love. If anybody's in here military, this is great. Somebody went there and they said, you know, you need to guard your important sites and we'll tell you how to do it. First, put up three hills. You can see off just off to the left is one, in the middle is one, and off here to the right is a third. Put up three hills and put gun emplacements on all three. And then you only have to man one, but you have three so they don't know which one's manned at any one time. And then paint them. And if it were a little dark, you could see they're painted kind of a white with green splotches on them. Camouflage paint. Now stop and think about that a second. You're in an absolutely flat country. You're a jet pilot. You want to find where the military targets are. What do you look for? Look for three hills painted white and green. You think I'm kidding. This is one. We went to another one. Here we are by a river guarding a bridge. You see in the middle one, just off to the right the second, and I couldn't get the third one in the picture, but there were three there. These are the only ones, by the way, that even kind of matched the scenery. It was green. Went past another area, right in the middle, one, two, three. This is guarding a little army base. Before I tell you about this man, just let you know, Israel, remember, went in and bombed that Iraq's nuclear reactor. And you always think, boy, oh man, the Israelis are fantastic soldiers. Well, that's true. But you also have to remember who they're fighting against at times. That kind of mentality. Do everything by the book. But Iraq is getting better at being in the army. This war with Iran has done it. The first time I was there, Iraq was losing. In fact, they flew us in the middle of the night, not during the day. They wouldn't allow daylight flights into Baghdad. And it wasn't going well at all. This last year, the 3 months before I went, Iraq had a series of stunning victories against Iran. In fact, they were so impressive that the war ground to a halt before I got there in September. And, of course, Iraq wanted to put that on display, so they took a huge area in the middle of Baghdad to put this weapons of war on display. And they just sent a brigadier general with us journalists to show us all the things they had captured. 60,000 rifles. You can see all the field artillery, field glasses here on the side. They just lined things up one by one. Tanks. Sometimes some of the best stuff America made. Because remember, we supplied the Shah's army, and when the Ayatollah took over, they still had all that equipment. Here's some of their heavier pieces. You can just see it's row on row on row of this stuff. Here was their prized possession. When you heard about the attack on Basra, they had these long-range guns. The Iraqis moved so swiftly, the Iranians couldn't even move their guns away, and they captured them intact. So they put this one, again, notice where they put it on a hill. Set it up for display. And then all the helmets and the Kalashnikovs and the bazookas, light artillery pieces. By the way, just off to the left here, you see a head just sticking in the picture. The guy looked down, And at the time, there was a big heated debate on using chemical warfare. And they had captured all these Iranian chemical warfare packets, so that if you had a gas attack and you breathed a little, you took this thing with atropine and you injected yourself. And there were a whole bundle of them. So we started taking pictures, and the men came up and said, do not take pictures of those. And I didn't want to lose my film, so I took a picture of him taking a picture of those. Some of the light infantry weapons, just if you can picture acres of this stuff. And it was all, this was all captured within the last 3 months of the war. And, of course, even the soldiers wanted to get in on it. They asked us to take their picture. So we got theirs. Now, that's Iraq. And to understand Iraq, you need to understand Saddam Hussein. And you need to understand his ties. He's trying to make himself the new Nebuchadnezzar. And to do that, he's trying to unite everyone around him against their two enemies, Iran and Israel. And the connection is Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon. Babylon, because Babylon destroyed Israel, Babylon was destroyed by the Iranians. So he says, let's build Babylon. We'll be able to be a great power and destroy Israel again. And let's build our Alamo, our Babylon. And never again will we allow the hated Iranians into our country. Now, when you think of Babylon, this is what you usually think of. Ruins. In fact, you read a lot of books and the man says, well, I was there and my guide wouldn't let me stop there overnight. And we heard hyenas howling in the distance. And you read all these books. The problem is everything they wrote isn't true. They either were at a different spot or they weren't where Babylon was. Yes, there are ruins. And this is Babylon, and much of the city is in ruins. And yet not all of it. For the last 20 years, Saddam Hussein has been working on restoring the city of Babylon. And the way he's doing it is going back to the time of Nebuchadnezzar. In fact, here's some of the walls, the procession street leading into Babylon that he's rebuilt. The bottom part of this picture are the original bricks from Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. They excavate down to find the bricks, and then you see the top row and the part of the next one above it, the new bricks. Literally, on the base of the ancient bricks, they're building the new bricks. Here we are walking into the procession street for Babylon. And this is the procession street, the street Daniel would have marched down to go into the city of Babylon. Now, while we were there, they decided to hold this little festival. And if you can picture this, you walk in at night, and here's part of our group walking in, and lining the whole way are these men dressed in these tunics, holding lights for you to walk in. You sit down, and they start having a procession come into the street, reenacting what Nebuchadnezzar would have done. Here come some boys holding the palm branches, the peace that Nebuchadnezzar and Saddam Hussein brought. Men holding brass trumpets, marching through the city. And then the soldiers, dressed like Nebuchadnezzar's troops, complete with shield and spear, followed by the archers of Nebuchadnezzar, just row on row of these archers marching in, followed by more musicians, and these men were playing the drums that they had, followed by women playing the lyres as they marched in. And this one, I'm sorry it came out very dark, but it's actually picturing the royal family being pulled in a chariot into Babylon. And then this is absolutely my favorite picture. Here are the men coming through in their swords. Now, notice the back row, second one from the right. That's how I would rather march, rather than sandals, mind you. They march in the procession way and through the Ishtar Gate into the city of Babylon. This is the original Ishtar Gate that Nabopolassar, Nebuchadnezzar's father, built. It was rebuilt by Nebuchadnezzar later in his reign. In fact, he covered this over, built a gate on top of it, so you had to walk up to Babylon. The original gate they found is in Berlin Museum. They uncovered this one and they left it on site. This is the gate Daniel would have walked in when he was taken captive to Babylon. You walk along and the bricks are still on the walls that Daniel would have seen. In fact, you get up close, here's what he has. They have bulls put on these walls, and then there would have been glazing over them. But the bull is a symbol of strength and fertility, and Babylon was the strong, mighty nation. Notice the detail, exquisite detail. Now, they found some of these that still had the glazing. In fact, this is a bad picture, but you can see it was even glazed with gold and blue on it originally. They also had, and this I found very interesting, it's a dragon. But if you look at it closely, you notice it has scales on its body like a snake. And if you look real close at the head, you'll see a horn on the head, and then sticking out of the mouth is a little forked tongue, the snake's forked tongue. So it's a snake. But if you look at the two front feet, the two front feet have paws, feline paws, the paws of a lion. The back two legs have bird's claws. And if you could look real close at the tail ends up with a scorpion's stinger. Two things about this. One, you come to Genesis chapter 3, the serpent in the garden, and the serpent's made to crawl on all fours, and you think, wow, where would they ever get an idea of a serpent that wouldn't crawl? Well, it's all through the Middle East, and I think they're preserving the same tradition, that at one time the serpent did have legs, and God judged it. A second thing, you come to Daniel chapter 7, and Daniel describes these weird beasts, and you think, oh man, would the guy have a pizza before he went to bed, or what? Daniel's writing in a context, he describes a beast, and it's no more different than this, a composite creature. Understanding the culture really helps explain those books in the Bible. Now here's what it looked like again. They were colored, completely glazed. It's a bad picture because I wasn't allowed to use a flash, but you can get the idea. Now if you can picture it, that night with that procession, after they got done marching, you marched through the Ishtar gate, all lit up, into Babylon, mighty Babylon. Now we're going to go inside the city. They have to have a new reconstruction of the Ishtar gate, so they built this half-scale model of the Ishtar gate that leads into the Nebuchadnezzar Museum. Here's a little closer picture. You walk through this into Babylon today. You get inside, and it has pictures of Nebuchadnezzar, but they're all strategically designed. Here's Nebuchadnezzar building the Ninmach Temple. I'll show you a picture of that. Saddam Hussein has rebuilt the Ninmach Temple. Here's Nebuchadnezzar looking over the mighty Babylon he's built. Saddam Hussein is rebuilding Babylon. Here's Nebuchadnezzar leading his troops in attack against Jerusalem. And Saddam Hussein would like nothing better than to lead the Arab people in an attack against Jerusalem. You go into the Nebuchadnezzar Museum that they have there. They have all these things to Nebuchadnezzar, including a model of the Tower of Babel. The talk that when I was there last time is that they're going to rebuild this, and it's going to be a hotel. So you can go and stay in the Tower of Babel maybe in a couple years. I may come out speaking French or something, who knows. But they also found in Babylon this lion. By the way, these are all my ethnomusicologist friends. But notice, you can see it's kind of defaced, but here's a basalt lion, and he's crouching over top of a man. The man's laying down his back, and the lion's standing on him. This was probably part of Nebuchadnezzar's palace, but the symbol of the lion, the king of beasts. And Nebuchadnezzar's strength and Babylon's strength over all others. Now here's a model of the Ninmach Temple. They've actually reconstructed this based on the excavations, based on other sites that they excavated outside of Babylon, and based on tablets they found there. And so right inside here's a rebuilt temple to Ninmach, or Emach, the goddess of Babylon. And looking at those doors, it's hard to picture the height, but those doors are not quite as high as this ceiling, but probably two-thirds of the way up in this room. It's a huge area. And the night we were there, we got to hear the great East German folk group, Peter und Paul. And so they would say something in German, you know, blowing in the wind. But they were using these temples for their celebrations at night. Now here's the area, and what I want you to picture, see that thing way in the distance, just beyond the minibus? That is the gateway into Nebuchadnezzar's palace. This is 2 years ago. Actually, the white wall on the right, this is where we walked past, climbed over the walls into the city the first time. But you see that gateway? This, all you see there is Nebuchadnezzar's southern palace. Here you can see it from another angle. You can see the gateway into the city. This is in 87. And there, give you an idea of the size. You could drive a bus through those gateways. And here's some of the walls. They dug down to the foundations and found the original walls. And way in the distance there where that other bus is, that's the throne room of Nebuchadnezzar. Probably the spot where the handwriting on the wall took place for Belshazzar. Here we are. In fact, they were broadcasting from there at night. These are all, again, 1987. And some of the things they found in that excavations were some of these lion reliefs on the walls, again, leading to his throne room. Now, remember that giant walkway you could drive a bus through you saw alone? There it is in the middle. And notice what you see on the side of it? In 1 year's time, they built all the walls around the southern palace. They worked this last year to restore the palace of Nebuchadnezzar. And where that tiny little wall was that crawled over, it's now a giant wall. You couldn't make it over that if you tried. This was their year's project. Here you can see at night what the walls look like. I apologize for these pictures. They were taken at dusk because they wouldn't take us there early enough. And I was running around trying to find everything I could, but... this is the entryway. It was one on the outside and three portals on the inside. into the southern palace. You went into that entryway, there was a courtyard, and then another entryway, another courtyard, and still another entryway, all built this last year. Here you can see further in. And all the way in, once you walk through both the courtyards, the three entryways, you're at the throne room of Nebuchadnezzar. And here we are, where it was partially done the year before, now completely done. This throne room was so big that they could hold 500 of us spectators in chairs and still have a stage. So when it talks about Nebuchadnezzar holding a feast for 1,000 of his, or Belshazzar for 1,000 of his nobles, it could be held in that throne room without any trouble. The throne would have been back against that recess in the back wall. Just outside, this is something they built this last year, just outside the throne room is a giant mountain that they put in the last year. It wasn't there in 87. They built three of these around Babylon, and their goal was to put a train, an aerial tram, around the whole city. Well, it was getting dark. You can see the sun's going down, but I ran up that hill.